The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
And this is Adrian Kennedy in for Kieran until 7 o'clock. And as you just heard, it's time for the Thursday interview. My guest this week is a Fine Gael politician who's a member of the European Parliament for the Dublin constituency since last summer. She was a TD for Meath East from 2011 to 2020. She was the leader of Fine Gael in the Shannon from 2020 to 24 and serving as leader of the Shannon from 2020 to 2022. But now it's all focused on Europe. I'm joined by Regina Doherty in the studio. Regina, thanks very much indeed
for
coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Great to see you.
Happy New Year.
Let me go back to the start of your story in the political world. You were originally a councillor in Meath. How did you get involved, or what made you get involved in politics?
I suppose I was kind of born into it. So I was an only child for the first 12 years of my life. And Mam and Dad would have been very involved in politics. They were very involved in Fine Gael. We set up branches in Ballymun where we lived, and then in Finglas East where we lived. And like, there wasn't probably money or maybe such thing as babysitters in those days, in the 70s and the 80s. So I just got brought everywhere with them. And so they did leaflet drops, or if they went to Ardèche, or, you know, I can remember one particular Ardèche going in my communion dress. And, you know, so like that, it was just part of their life, which meant it was part of mine. And so I always grew up very, very interested in current affairs, in politics. I probably never knew anything different other than Fine Gael until my late teens, early 20s, when I then started looking at not just other parties, but also world politics and the impact of, you know, different issues around the world. But never had a notion of ever being a politician. Just loved politics and being nosy and finding stuff out, but never had a notion until... I was the treasurer of our constituency at the time, and the lady that was running to be on the ticket, we were having a balance ticket with Shane McEntee, who unfortunately then passed away. She announced just before Christmas of the election that she was standing back, and they came and they asked me would I run, and I kind of thought it was the maddest idea ever, but you're like, if you don't try new things.
So it wasn't part of a big master plan.
No,
it just kind of happened by chance.
Not at all. No, I was in sales. That's all I'd ever known and done. Loved the job. The work was going well. But like, come here, they just decided it was the mad thing for me to do. And sure, why not? And I gave it a shot. And I ran in the 2007 general election and didn't win. And it does kind of bruise you a bit because, you know, everybody tells you not to take it personally, but you don't know how else you do take it. If people don't vote for you, there's a reason that has to do with you mostly. But again, I ran then in 2009 for the local elections, became a county councillor in Meath.
And that's where you started cutting your teeth.
History,
yeah, so. Well, obviously, very different types of setups between the local council and now where you are in the European Commission. But in terms of cutting your teeth at council level, I always see it as a very important start, a very good place to start.
I often say to colleagues who go straight into the Dáil or the Shannon, or even to the European Parliament, when they don't have relationships with particularly the officials and the workers, the fellas and women who actually do the work on the ground, if you don't have relationships with them, no matter what high-flying title you have thereafter, you still have to pick up the phone and develop relationships with people, because people buy from people, people do for people, you know. And I think the 2 years that I had in the council really afforded me the opportunity to develop relationships with officials and workers that then was incredibly beneficial to me thereafter, because if I ever needed anything done, they knew me, they knew my way, I knew their way, and we worked well together. And I think that was really impactful to me, particularly as a TD for Meath before I became a minister, because it helped me do my job well. So,
and then eventually, 2011, you were elected TD and served right up until 2020. We'll talk about that in a second.
Yeah.
What do you think was your proudest achievement in those 9 years?
Probably hot school meals. It was a struggle to get the money for it because it wasn't something that was in the programme for government. And anybody that knows anything about government knows that if it's not in the programme for government, you don't get it done. So it was a bit of a miracle that I got the money to do the pilot. And then Pascal Donoghue was very good to me and he allowed me to extend it, even though it wasn't in the programme for government. And it's now a rip-roaring success. And I'm really, really pleased about that. But I have to be honest with you, like, I loved every minute of all of that. I loved being a backbench TD. I loved being on the health committee and showing up at 9 o'clock on a Thursday morning, you know, when the corridors were quiet. I loved being chief whip, even though I was only chief whip for a year, because I learned probably more about myself that year than I did about anybody else. And then I absolutely adored being the Minister for Social Protection. Probably so much so that I forgot to be the TD, which then, you know, we have a very parochial system in this country. That if
and that's what I was about to bring you to, because almost exactly 5 years ago, well, yeah, in a couple of weeks, we had the 2020 election. Fine Gael lost a number of seats and you, unfortunately, were one of the victims. Yeah. Did you take it personally?
I kind of knew it was coming, so it wasn't like it was a big surprise. Other people, you know, do get a wallop and they don't see it coming, and I think that probably is very hurtful. I saw it coming, and when I reflect back now and look, like, I know the reasons why I lost my seat, and a lot of them were my own fault, right? But would I change the effort that I put into auto enrolment? Would I change the effort that I put into women's pensions, into hot school meals? All of the work that I did, you know, was really valuable. Now, nobody's going to thank you for it. And I'm not trying to be smart or anything, right? But I thoroughly enjoyed the work that I did, to the extent that I probably did stop being the TD that people needed. And that's why they picked somebody else. And I'm a real firm believer that everything happens for a reason. So, right, on the Monday morning after I lost my seat, was I gutted? Yeah. Of course I was gutted. But it actually, it's funny, it was why I was able to ring people this time who lost their seats, because I know how it feels. But I also know every time a door shuts in your face, there's a window somewhere. You mightn't see it on the same day, but there's a window somewhere. And despite, though, after that election, deciding I was nearly 50, I would have been 50 the following year, I kind of decided, right, I've had a wonderful experience and a really great opportunity afforded me. Maybe now it's time to go and do something else. And I made the decision then to go off and to do something else. And then sure, COVID happens. And
that's what I was about to say. We had that strange experience for, it seemed like months on end, where we had an acting government. And the same is happening as we speak. Yep. What was that like serving still as a minister when you'd actually lost your Dáil seat? What was that experience like?
So I suppose in the beginning, particularly because I had lost my seat, and I reflected with others, colleagues afterwards, did they feel any different? And actually they tell me they didn't. But I felt a little bit of an imposter because I had lost my seat. And so the message had been loud and clear, obviously, from people they didn't want me anymore. But I actually didn't have a choice but to make the decisions, because apart from the Department of Health, which obviously was hugely instructive in the beginning days and for every other day in COVID, the single biggest department that looked after people was the Department of Social Protection. And we needed to make decisions, and we needed to make them fast, faster than we've ever seen in the history of the state before. And the only person that was going to lead that was me and the team that were there. And the team were absolutely superb. And I had no choice but to say, shut up with your anxiousness or whatever it was that I felt, and get on with the job. And we did, and we introduced an enhanced illness payment for people, so that when they did get sick, they could stay at home as opposed to maybe taking a risk and going to school or work or whatever. And then very, very quickly, that became the COVID payment, the PUP. And again, you know, in a way, that's another thing I'm probably quite proud of, because we did do something for over a million people that went from a paper-based system to an online-based system in literally a matter of weeks. And anybody, again, that knows anything about public service and civil servants and officialdom, nothing happens in weeks. And the people, the men and the women in the Department of Social Welfare, made enormous sacrifices to make sure that we looked after people. And we did look after people. And again, right, there were some criticisms of it because it wasn't flexible enough. You know, we overpaid people, you know, because we only had the quickest way wasn't going to be the perfect way. And it took months to obviously finesse it, which we did do. But speed was the most important thing, that when the country was shut down on the 20th of March, we had to make sure that people had money to put food on their table, you know. So I think they did an incredible job, and it was my pleasure to be there. And then, you know, the other half of that meant enough whinging and wondering what you're going to do for the rest of your life. There's a job now to be done here. And the one thing that I do have enormous grow for is that couple of months, and we worked really, really hard, made me think, what in the name of God were you ever thinking about giving this up for? You love this job. You love doing this job, and you love working with the people that you work with. So
when that term came to an end, when Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and the Greens finally agreed a programme for government and went into government, you became the Taoiseach's nominee for the Shannon. Were you expecting that?
No. So, obviously the week before it happened, I was told, and so therefore I was expecting it. But I had worked really, really hard and very, very closely, both with Leo, with Simon Harris, with Simon Coveney, with the team in the department. And I had obviously then started to have conversations with people to say maybe it was very short-sighted of me, maybe I should have run for the Shannon elections. Now, at that point, it was too late, and I hadn't. And Leo came and he asked me would I consider staying, and I bit the leg off him and said absolutely, thanks very much, and delighted. And then the absolute cherry for me on the cake was that I got to be part of that leadership team in the Shannon with Lisa Chambers. So the two of us led and deputy led the Shannon for the last 5 years. And again, it's a really privileged place to be, because it's a very thoughtful place. It's a very, very different place to the Dáil, because you journalists are not looking at us all day, every day. So there's no need for the banter and the, you know, point scoring and stuff. And people actually genuinely work together and get stuff done.
And so, is there a need for it? We know we've had debate in this country about the need to have an upper house. Is there a need for it? And what is that need?
So the question was asked of the Irish people in 2013, if I recall, and very clearly they said that, yeah, they didn't trust politicians only to have one set of eyes on things, that it was important that we had two sets of eyes that maybe had different reflections and different ambitions. And I think very clearly we can see the analysis maybe of the hate speech bill over the last year and a half, 2 years in the Shannon has made significant changes to what we finally saw was enacted only a number of days ago. So it definitely does have a role. It definitely needs to be reformed. And it's something that was promised in the 2013 referendum, and it still hasn't happened yet.
And what sort of reform do you think it needs?
So one of the things that's going to happen in the next year is that the university panels should be and will be voted upon by a much larger audience of university graduates than it currently is. But also maybe the way we elect, you know, the other 43 seats are not quite as democratic as they could be. To be elected by just under 1,000 politicians gives it the opinion and the appearance of being a house for politicians by politicians. And I think maybe if it was something like the American system where we had half, you know, elected during half terms, you might get a different reflection. But it definitely has its value. And I think it's proven that and shown that in the last number of years. And I would say that given that I was there, but it is a very thoughtful place and you can see people really working together. People who wouldn't ordinarily ever agree on things can find spaces to actually work collaboratively. Which is, you know, it's a good way to work. And it's a way the European Parliament works, because there is no government and opposition in the European Parliament. So maybe we could take a few lessons.
So let's talk about that. For somebody who a few years ago was thinking of packing it all in, you've done the exact opposite, running back in the summer for the European Parliament. What has that transition been like?
Honestly, the first couple of weeks were a little daunting. And I say that having been around in politics for 15 years and sat in various chambers. And so it wasn't like I stood up and my legs wobbled because I had to speak. But it is a much grander scale. I mean, there's 700 plus 720 MEPs. And so when you go into a parliamentary party meeting, there's hundreds of people there, not just, you know, 50 or 60. So the grandness of it, the scale of it is very, very big. And also, obviously, everybody speaks a different language. You have to find your common ground. But also, because of the way the work is done within committee systems, and everything is to hand, so everything is reflective of the size of your party and the size of your country, there is no government opposition. There's no whip system to speak of that we, you know, understand here. So you build consensuses to get things done. And you only build consensuses by developing relationships. And so it's all about crossing the stage, finding somebody from the left, even the right, even though you mightn't like some of the ideologies that either of those, you know, groups of politicians espouse, to find consensus on issues. And for something that you might agree with somebody on a Monday, you might vehemently oppose them on a Thursday, but it's finding the consensus around the policy, not the person, not the party, not the country. You know, and I think that's...
The one thing I always think of the European Parliament is it's far away. As you said, with regard to the Shannon, the eyes of the population aren't on you all the time. So what do you do? Like, what are you working on at this moment? People in Dublin elected you. What are you doing right now?
So I'm on three and a half committees. I'm a substitute member on one of my committees. The biggest committee I'm on is the Economic Committee. The second committee is Internal Markets. An awful lot of it is around trade, finance, financial security. It's around consumer affairs. A lot of that is consuming. The Employment and Social Affairs Committee I'm on is probably a hallmark from the fact that I was the Employment and Social Protection Minister for 4 years. So I know the people. What I'm working on at the moment is two things. Number one, and both of them are around financial security. The amount of people in this country who don't qualify for a pension, and unfortunately, Adrian, the vast majority of them are women, There's about 100,000 people who are over pensionable age in Ireland who don't qualify for a pension, not a contributory pension or not a means-tested pension. And it's because they don't have enough cons. And whilst that's not unique to Ireland, there is a disparity right across the European Union. So there is no woman or man that should have ever contributed to the state be denied a pension, even if it's only a tenner a week because they only have 10 contributions. But there's nobody should be denied the reality of existence, the contribution that they've made to the state, and have it returned to them. And the reason I probably feel so strongly about this particular issue is that an awful lot of the people in Ireland are women. And the reason they don't have enough cons is because we made them give up work in 1973. And they're all in their late 60s, early 70s now. And they don't exist as far as the state's concerned. Now, some of them are lucky enough or unlucky enough that maybe their husband's pension isn't enough and so they get a means-tested pension. But it's still not even in their own right. It's off the back of their husband's.
But what can the European Parliament do to rectify that situation in all 27 countries?
So I'll give you an example of two things that we're doing at the moment. And one of them involves women, and well, actually both of them are around specific groups of people that are excluded from the social welfare system. One of them is foster carers and one of them is retained firefighters. Both of them are excluded from the social welfare system because we don't consider them as workers. And so therefore, even though they get an allowance on a weekly basis for the work they do, and the state wouldn't be able to survive without them, and that's true in every member state in the European Union, we don't consider them workers, so therefore they don't get a con. And if you don't get a contribution according to the state, well, then you don't get a pension. That's wrong. We wouldn't be able to survive in this country or any other European Union without the work that foster carers do and the work that retained firefighters do. The work they do, not the contribution or the allowances. Or, you know, they work. And so therefore, I want our committees to recognise the work that they do as work. And so therefore, bring them into the social welfare system. And I really believe that if I can do that, then I can address the tens of thousands of women across the European Union who don't get any money from any state because their contribution wasn't seen as enough. We talked recently in Ireland, and the referendums were both rejected by the Irish people, about the value of the Irish woman's place in the home and her contribution to society and the common good. And yet we ignore up to 100,000 of them, and we say as a state that they don't even exist. That's not good enough, and I want to change that.
I had a load of other things I wanted to talk to you about, but unfortunately time has got the better of us. It's been a pleasure having you on
thank
the programme. Dublin MEP, Fine Gael MEP, Regina Doherty, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.